Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin sale, bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin sale, bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Am I getting the problem? You're the one saying it. If loving one another, if identifying yourself as African and relating to each other as African and thinking in terms of each other as African, and behaving individually in terms of your African descent and relationship to other people means the overthrow of Europeans, you are going to have trouble in self-love and relating one with one another and loving one another. If being able to trust each other, if being able to be reliable in your relationship with each other and keeping your words with each other and supporting each other means that you can then form a collective force, being a majority, against European power. One of the greatest problems you're going to have with each other is what? Trust. We must be suspicious of each other. respect. You must be what? Unreliable in our relationship, one with the other. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the characteristics that are necessary to maintain the European system are bred into the African personality. That's why when I talk about the education of black children, you recognize that the education of black children resembles nothing like the education of white children. The whole curricular approach and the pedagogical approach would have to be different. Because we must put back into our children and into ourselves what has been taken out and what has been repressed if we are to liberate ourselves. But as I'm going to talk in a minute, many of us have bought this stupid idea called standard education and equal education. And it has been buying of those ideas, standard education, equal education, that we've been destroyed and will be destroyed as people. No such thing as equal education. No such thing as a standard education. I talk to you, Mr. No such thing as standard discipline. We love the concept. In fact, we'll engage in a discussion on education without even defining what we're talking about. We'll just assume education is what we've always been doing and what white folks have been doing all along. It doesn't occur to us that we need to redefine the whole concept. We need to ask ourselves why, for what purpose are our children reading? Why are they learning, man? You have a problem sometimes when your children come back and say, Daddy, why did I have to study this? It's hard to sometimes come up with a reason other than what? Working for the slave master. Yeah, think beyond that. Think how often you said, so you can get a job. You know? And move so farther beyond that. You know? And that creates problems. White Buffer Stoneman, we have been consigned the role of consumers in this system. We think of ourselves as consumers. Our purpose in this world, as far as the world system is concerned, is to buy. Not to produce, but to consume. We measure ourselves against whites in terms of the amount of consumption that we engage in, not in terms of production. We think that a man who drives a Cadillac is equal to the man that makes it. Yeah, and we confuse the two things. So we think we drive Cadillac like white folk, we live in houses like white folk, we eat like white folk, we talk like white folk. You know, we are like white folk. That's a lie. That's a cruel deception. You will never make it up in the world and gain any respect among people and have any power through consumption. You only gain respect and you only gain power through production, not through buying, ladies and gentlemen. No African nation or any group of people can buy themselves into respect and buy themselves into power. And you have leaders who misled you in many ways by comparing your income against white income. You see, a terrible misleading situation. Because income and wealth are not the same thing. You may have an income of $100,000 a year because you're getting a check for so much per month. That's quite different from a man who has an income based on the fact that he owns $10 million worth of property. You see, so when people are running the income game on you, because you know, when you blow that check, when you get fired next month, you're done. That $100,000 of wealth is nothing. In fact, it is not even wealth. It ends right at that point. You see? But a man with $10 million worth of property has got a lot more resources and possibilities, you see. But we have, our leaders have compared income instead of wealth. And this has created tremendous problems with us. As a matter of fact, it is time for us now to question black leadership, period. You look at the condition that black people are in today, with crack and unemployment and homelessness and all of the other kind of things, and you basically have the same black leadership you've had for the past 30 years. It is is about time for you to begin to question the validity of that leadership. If these people were running for president and so forth, you would have thrown them out of office a long time ago. Because you would say, hey, look at when you came in and look at where we are now. How can you validate your leadership looking at the concrete condition of our people? We don't call our leaders in the past. You've been led by the NAACP, the Urban League, and various other so-called black organizations which are really not black and never have been from their inception, and have led to the situation where we are today, where economically we are suffering to a very great extent. We've had leaders who protested against our not being hired in places where we spend our money. But we haven't had leaders who have talked about what? Only those places. I have a business here at 125th Street, and while I can appreciate adequate power struggle against discrimination in hiring, and that was a magnificent struggle years ago, and finally getting blacks hired in those places. Yet I look at that same street today, and you can count on the fingers of one hand how many black people actually own anything on that street. Even though 95% of the customers on the street are black people. And yet you have a Charles Rangel and a bunch of others there who seem to have little or no concern about that situation and deal with that situation. And we send them the Congress year after year after year after year. We have to check this kind of thing out. We have been run then by what we call non-economic liberalism. The NAACP with no economic program, the Urban League with no economic program. I have a book here, a beautiful book. They put out beautiful books every year. The State of Black America, 1988. They'll have the State of Black America, 1989. The state of, you know, every year, State of Black America. Wonderful statistics. But no theory, no program. Mm. See? No program at all there. And yet we permitted ourselves to let these people set policy for us. And we are reaping the results of it. They overran Washington, Booker T. Washington's program. They overran Marcus Garvey and others. And now we can see the results of it. We in fact believe in group, in individual wealth as against group wealth. We are, in a sense, the only true Americans in America, black people. We really believe in that stuff. We really believe in individualism. And yet we are the most stereotyped people in the country. We are viewed as stereotypes by other people. We are rarely seen as individuals by other people. And yet we are the most firm believers in individualism. It's a pity. Do your own thing. You do yours and I do mine. Because the reality is all other ethnic groups act in terms of their ethnicity. And the reality is America is a pluralistic society, not a society of individuals. The reality is that there is no individual power without group power. You cannot become an individual, ultimately, until your group becomes collectively strong. The reason why we see white people as individuals is because of white power. If they had no power and they were powerless, we just see them as a bunch of powerless poor people. You have some Negroes who play tricks on their mind and say, I don't see color. And then you're not seeing color matter. Because you don't see color means that someone else has said me what? That somebody else don't see you as what? Colored. Yeah. So we think if we deny our color and deny with ourselves as people of color, that somehow that relaxes to me means that the other people don't see us as possessing color. terrorism. And you'll see it almost all the time when a Negro's getting ready to give his money away to white folks or to justify not supporting African people, you'll almost hear that statement in America. I don't see color. And I recognize that that's exactly the state of mind you have to be in so that other people can pick your pocket. You see, not seeing color. You can ultimately only gain individual strength through group strength. I talk to college students sometimes by saying, you know, many of you think that you're here at this college, particularly those that predominantly white colleges and so forth, because you come from, you know, some big family, because you scored high on the SATs, because you studied hard and you stayed away from the parties and you did all of this. I'm right here at the great university you are today. Lies. You think you're the first person that came from good family? You think you're the first generation that had good family? Black people have had good families from the beginning. You think you're the first generation that studied hard? You think you're the first generation of blacks who can score high on SAT exams? Yet I grew up in a generation of people where it didn't matter how high you could score in the exam, how much you had studied, you, there were just certain colleges you were not going to, period. Period. In fact, you don't even bother, they didn't even give you the exam to take. Don't bother to apply. How did we get into those schools? Not because of the scores we made and so forth, but because blacks without degrees, the blacks who've never seen the inside of a college and others, put their bodies on the line because of black power, because of the collective activity of black people. That collective activity then permits you as an individual now to have a choice of college. It permits you to choose your profession. It permits you to say, well, I'll be a computer engineer, I'll be this, I'll be that. But remember, that choice is based on what? Group power. And the willingness of the black group to back that right up. It is not a right that is inherited you as an individual, and it is not a right that's just given to you simply because you were born, or simply because you went to the right school.
All right.
And when those people in those universities and other places decide they want to take it back from you, you will have to be that black community again that will stand up and say no. And we forget that often. You know, we got a lot of people now, they got a little position in the world, and they want to make it, you know, they want to say it's all the result of their own individual assets. You see? No, it is group power that makes individual choice possible. Which means then that we try to increase our wealth and power as black people, we then must increase it in terms of increasing the power and wealth of the whole group. Or else, individual power and wealth is a mere illusion. I look at Johnson Publications, for instance, and I look at the difference between that magazine in the 60s and what it is today, and how in many ways it cannot deal with real issues in terms of black folk. And even though he may have millions of dollars, in a way there's a fundamental weakness there. Why? Because he cannot afford to do what? Insult his what? White advertising. So his wealth is really not what? Power, as it would be among the others. His wealth, but in a way, his wealth is also his what? His weakness. I, being poor and without anything, can say what I want to. If he had, though, a black nation doing business and creating wealth, he too could say what he wanted to say. Because he'd have that wealth and nation of people supporting what he had to say. But because he must depend upon another people, he cannot afford to insult them. And yet, when you deal with the real issues of black people, you must insult white folk. And so the idea that you can have individual wealth not tied up to the wealth of black people as a group is an illusion of wealth and an illusion of power. And yet many of us have bought into this kind of situation. So we got a lot of us trying to run this little individual game without understanding that it has to be all or none. We've got caught in our educational problems because we believe the white man is invincible, that he cannot be defeated. Miserable belief. All people throughout history, all civilizations rise and fall. Many people ask me, why did we fall as black people? On a metaphysical level, if you're the first to rise, you'll be what? Basically the first to fall. That's the way life. Civilizations go through what? Cycles. There's not been one yet that will have lasted for what? Forever. You've had Romans, Greeks, you know, Africans, this one and that one. And ladies and gentlemen, the white man is going to go one day too. I know it's kind of hard to believe. And I'm sure you could have convinced the Romans that one day the Roman Empire would be gone, or the Athenians that one day Athens would be gone, you know, but they're gone. And yet somehow in our psyche, black people, we just kind of believe he was what? Lasting forever. As invisible and cannot be overthrown. The Japanese and think so. When you get that mentality then, you give up. We just saw the idea of education as a solution to our background. Education is very important, because I know many of you were raised. Get that education. Fine, nothing wrong with it. Except that it is only a part of the solution, it is not the total solution. We, I insist on believe ourselves to be in eternal servitude. When I mentioned here earlier, that when our children ask us why should they be studying math, or why are they studying this and that, about the only excuse we can give them for it is so that they can get a job for other people, that the assumption that somehow white people will always own everything and control everything, and therefore the best we can do is to qualify to work for them. But isn't there a higher motivation? Isn't there a higher cause when you say you're studying math so that you can overthrow white economic power? So that you can outthink those people? That you are at war with these people economically, socially, and militarily? And the reason why you are studying is so that we can win this struggle for our lives and survival as a people? If you really saw education not as a job market, not as a way of merely moving up on the social ladder, but as necessary to your very survival, then you wouldn't have as much problem as you have getting down to these schools, seeing that those children learn what they should learn.
Right on.
You see? But you have not yet come to the realization that education is about survival, not about jobs. I was talking to a friend of mine just before I left this afternoon, and he was talking about a book he was reading called The Genetic Wars. How the Europeans have taken an African fever, dengue fever, and through gene splicing increased its potential, its dangerous potential, and how it could be sprayed on populations and so forth and used on populations. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal, now maybe 2-3 years ago, long piece, that talked about the U.S. germ warfare research, where 23 American universities were engaged in that research. Also, the New York Board of Health. Also, the Department of Agriculture. Also, MDs. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the university system of the United States is as much a part of the United States military establishment,
right,
as is any other institution. Jobs are secondary to their function. You see, when these planes drop bombs on your head, when these laser beam weapons fire from 500 miles out in space, with these germs such as AIDS and other germs be released, will be released on us and have been released on us. You must recognize that those things have not been created by people in the streets. Those things have been created by professors, by PhDs, and in the university laboratories of this country. That's why educated people are the most dangerous people in the world. It is not the crack dealers that will destroy this earth, ladies and gentlemen. It is not the muggers that will destroy this earth, ladies and gentlemen. It will be people with PhD degrees with two fair-haired children and a two-car garage. Upstanding, moral, church-going citizens who, after they leave service and rest Sunday night, go Monday morning to make bombs and weapons to destroy themselves, their children, and the whole of mankind on earth. And it's those professors who don't even teach very often, who are doing research for the government and doing research for the army and so forth, to such a degree now, to degree now, that the United States scientific establishment has been skewed in its orientation toward research by military research, which is one of the reasons why it cannot appropriately compete with Japan, because its best brains have been used in the creation of death machines, as against machines that can be used right. for commerce.
Right.
Understand that? That is why, you see, it is not enough for you to go to white schools and get degrees from white schools. You must own those schools and control those schools. I'll be back to that in a minute. One of the reasons why we have problems, too, economically, is the people we see racism as a psychomoral problem. Racism essentially is an economic problem. It is essentially a rationalization for maintaining economic, political, military, and other kind of controls over another people. It is not an attitude problem. We think that merely we change white folks' attitude if they realize we bleed like they do, and we do this like they do, they're going to come and love you out of your mind. Do you think merely by having these people believe their creed that you're going to get out of the situation you're in? No. This racism is a justification and a rationalization for maintaining economic, political, and social dominance. Even the apparent change of racism by whites is still going to be used to maintain their racial dominance. That is, when whites become less obviously racist in their overt attitudes, their wealth and their power will still remain where it is. As a matter of fact, they have learned that one of the best ways now of maintaining their power is to appear to be less overtly racist. Now, you think getting black mayors and governors elected represents some advancement for black people? And I realize, of course, we've been through this game before. This is the second Reconstruction anyway. You know, we're getting duped again. And you think that the moving of black people in the classes, in wealth and so forth, represents some advance for black people? I call it neoclassism to sort as a parallel with what? Neocolonialism. Where a minority which seeks to maintain its power, where it does not have numerical advantage, recruits from the very people it oppresses so that those recruits can be used to maintain the power and position of the original group. So the European recognizes that he can more efficiently dominate African economic affairs by having Africans as head of government than having himself as the chief governor of African countries. And now we're going to get a black middle class that puts a black face on white power. Let us not be deceived. So we think then that the problem that we are facing with whites and racism is a problem of morality. And this is in part the result of being led by preachers. You see, not having a strong secular leadership in the black community. because people tend to see problems in terms of their profession. And ministers, being concerned very much about moral issues, tend to moralize most issues. You see, but there's much more going on in this world than just the bad attitude. The other problems that we've looked at, the other reason why we have problems economics is we see our economic problems as resulting from civil rights. And let me just be rapid in terms of the time. Civil rights. It's like a prisoner saying, I have rights in prison. You know? Civil rights are not the same as what? Liberation and so forth. They're not the same as independence and control of oneself. But the thing that I want to get across is we have this faith in law. We think as long as the Supreme Court is up there, the government is up there, we have civil rights laws on the book, everything's going to be cool for us. Let me just quickly tell you one thing, ladies and gentlemen. If it gets down to the point of where the white man has to make a choice between feeding his children or yours, no amount of laws on books, no amount of Supreme Courts, no amount of black governors and mayors or anything else is going to have him feed your children before he feeds his own. The laws are only as strong as their enforcers. And the people who pass the laws are also the same people who enforce the laws. And when it comes to the point where they have to make a choice in terms of their survival and power as against your own, they will ignore the law or speak to or not enforce the laws. So ultimately, your salvation lies in power, not in goodwill of the other people, not in the love of the other people, not in laws on the books and all of that. It ultimately must rest on pure power and the ability to stop other people from doing harmful things to you. Anything else is not adequate. And yet we've had a bunch of leaders who think that laws on books are adequate to protecting the future of our children and of our people. You must realize that's a very flimsy basis. We believe in standard business practice. No such thing as standard business practice. You know, we have this idea that there are practices that have no regard to race or color. Wrong. I had to deal with a person the other day. Oh, this is standard business practice. No, these are white folks' business practices that have developed within a white European context, built around a white reality, a white economic system, white goals and values and so forth. This is not standard business practice. This is a practice among these people. You see? But when we buy that as standard, then we inevitably are defeated in our economic efforts. And this standard business is the idea of standard is a problem, as I pointed out earlier, even in education. Standard education. No such animal as standard education. There's only education that gets you where you need to go. I've stated again and again that the educational destiny of the black child is revolutionary, that the educational destiny of the white child is what? Conservative. The major focus of white education is to maintain the advantage that they already have. Black people not having advantages do not need to get the same education, because you're not being educated for the same reason. You're being educated to remove that advantage. You're being educated to feed your starving children. You're being educated to benefit from the wealth that is being stolen from the land of your ancestors. You're being educated to benefit from the wealth that you create here as a people. That means that our children must be reared to undertake their destiny and to undertake the tasks that lie before them. The problems that black children have to solve are not those that white children have to solve. Education is defined in terms of the problems people must solve. When you go to white schools, you are learning to solve white folks' problems. That's why you can work better for them and solve their problems better than you can your own. That's why, despite the fact that you have an MBA degree or business administration degree, you own virtually no businesses and you administer nothing belonging to yourself and you have no control over anything economic. In fact, the more degrees you've gotten, the more other people have taken your businesses from you in your neighborhoods. Which means you're being educated for servitude. So behind those, the highest educated black is in the same position as the lowest one, and that is they're being educated or not educated in service to white power. Intelligence, we are not even intelligent. Black people are made stupid by the education that they get. And the more education we get, the more stupid we become. Yes, I know this is harsh words, but we have to deal with the reality. We are literally educated into dumbness. We call being intelligent high scores on the SAT, high grades at Harvard and Yale. How much we created for IBM and how much we created for AT&T. Ladies and gentlemen, that has nothing to do with intelligence at all. You let another people define intelligence for you in such a way that it also means maintaining them in power. The ultimate value of intelligence, the ultimate point of intelligence, is to solve one's own problems and to secure one's own survival. God put intelligence in you so that you could adapt to the environment you live in or adapt the environment to you to further your own life and your own being. I don't care how much you know, how much you've learned, how deeply you've been educated by other people, if you cannot solve your own economic problems, if you cannot solve your own military problems, if you cannot secure your own survival, which should be the point of education, then you have been made dumb and stupid and ignorant by that education. That's why you have to get rid of the concept of equal education and the equating of same and equalness. You do not need the same education as white people. You do not have the same problem as white people. Therefore, you require a knowledge that is relevant to the problems that you have as a people. And when you solve those problems that confront you as a people, and you collect the information relevant to solving those problems, and you develop the mental skills and abilities and capacity to solve those problems, then you are intelligent. It has nothing to do with your record at Harvard or Yale or any of your recipes. Do you understand what I'm trying to get across?
Yeah.
That's why you must, number one, redefine every word you've been taught in America. You are defeated by the very fact that you don't look at the words you use. The very fact that you go into a discussion, male-female relations, education of black children, fight crime, without even saying, well, listen, how are we going to define crime? How are we going to define education? How are we going to define the purpose of the black family? Do you know that we have the right to determine any social arrangement called family that we want to? There's no such thing as any sacred family. White folks don't represent what a real family should be. Do you know that the family is reflective of the social political conditions under which a people survive? That we as black people have a right to say, wait a minute, looking at our current reality, looking at the future problems we want to solve, we believe that the best way to arrange a family and for black men and black women to relate is this way. It has nothing to do with the way white men do it. But we've never even thought about the fact we have that right. That right. You see? We've never realized that we can define family in the way we want. Feel like it. That's because we don't have a sense of people. And we don't have a sense of nation. When you think of yourself as a people, and when you think of yourself as a nation, then you know that a people and a nation have a right to make their own laws and rules. It's only when you lose that sense of people that you think you have to go and get authority to redefine yourself and develop yourself from another people. And therefore you're destroyed by accepting the definitions of other people and trying to impose those definitions on your situation, even though you live in vastly different situations. What do I say? You can't be like white folk, just like white folk. Why? Unless you are what? Black folk. Because people live not in terms of just their skin. They live in particular social, political, economic, historical situations and their personalities, their minds, and so their relationships and so forth are intricately related to the situations and circumstances under which they live. People then who do not live within the reality of their situation and live within their own sense of destiny and values and so forth are people who live outside of themselves and literally people who are literally out of their mind. And so you have a group of people who are trying to act like another group of people who are in a completely different set of circumstances and situations, you're going to have people who are misfunctional. Let me rush through as time is moving.
Take your time, bro.
Take your time.
And we die like to come back again.
Take your time.
We have a confusion of money with income. We haven't even defined what the economy is. A lot of us confuse money and economy. Having money is not having an economy. Economies existed prior to money. An economy ultimately is a set of social relations between people, ladies and gentlemen, not money, social relations. A systematic set of relationships between people. A crowd at a football stadium is not an economic system. It is a bunch of people with money in their pockets. Okay? The people who get their money are the people who have the what? The system. The hot dog vendors and the other people, they got a system. And they suck then the money out of those people's pockets. Wouldn't it be interesting if those people bought their own hot dogs and their own business? You know? Then they got what? If the fans themselves had what? An economic system, they would have cheaper hot dogs, cheaper beer, you know? They would have so many advantages if they thought of themselves and say, hey man, we're going to relate not just to the crowd of people all around, rah, we're going to relate as an economic system. You see a whole different ballgame going on. Now they got all of that money and they're sitting there in one place, but they're not an economy. This is a similar situation that we are in as people. We are the 9th or 10th richest nation on this earth in terms of our income. We spend more money here than Canada and many other nations. We, in fact, have a very high level, relatively speaking, of human resources, of people who have administrative skills and other kind of skills that other nations in this world would envy. But we are not a nation. We are a bunch of people who have a lot of knowledge, but we exist as well, individuals. Skills existing as well, individuals. People with money existing as individuals. But people with systems come in and value our money right out of our pocket. If though we related to each other in very definite social ways, then we could use our own money, you see? And then we could increase our wealth and develop our wealth. That is why, as I reported earlier, you see, the lack of trust, the lack of reliability, the like of not getting a kick when you buy something from black people instead of white folks. All of that has been implanted for economic reasons. Every maladjusted characteristic that you find in the black personality serves an economic function for Europeans. And you just stop and think about it for a minute. Your lack of self-confidence means that you don't want to take any risk in going into business. So therefore, you will not represent any challenge to any other people. The other people with self-confidence come and go into business in your community. The people who want to take risks come and go into business in your community. The people who relate to each other socially such that they can pool their money together go into business in your community. People who are reliable in their relationship one to the other go into business in your community. People, I mentioned the other day on the radio show that blacks, 12 or 13% of this population, they buy 34% of the cosmetics because one of the reasons is we are unhappy about our African features and we seek to alter those features. And therefore we support a whole cosmetic industry because of the attitude we have toward our own local people. Do you think that these people will ever get you to be happy with your local? As a matter of fact, I think it was Chanel or somebody told somebody, look, there's no such thing as natural beauty. You know what she said? natural beauty is our enemy. She's in the cosmetic. But we never want to tell people there's something called what? Natural beauty. Are you kidding? We must tell them that beauty can only be taken from a jar. Or else get out of it. So consequently, then, you must make people all have a certain feeling of unbeauty when they are not what? Cosmetized in some sort of manner. And it is out of this feeling of inadequacy that wealth is created. And therefore, those people who create the wealth must maintain those people in this feeling of inadequacy. Therefore, feeling inadequate about yourself is a large source of money for whites. And therefore, they will never let you out. I don't care how many songs you sing and how much you say black is beautiful, until you know it and act it within yourself, it's going to be utilized. And you can go from characteristics to characteristics. We don't have time to do it tonight. But you have to realize these characteristics have been put into us for very definite economic reasons. You have to think you can fly like those ads do with those sneakers on. Foolish. Chinese working 16 hours a day. What, $3 a week? Two weeks off for the year or something like that? Sneakers cost maybe $10 or $15 to make, selling to you for $175. And you're so foolish you'll go out and kill somebody and snatch them up some people's feet. It's an amazing situation. You have to be out of your mind to go for that. We have a lack of understanding of the relationship between wealth and power and government. Government is about money. It's about wealth. Black people think it's about models. We want our children to have models. No, you want those politicians to shoot that money in your direction. It's not just, what good is thinking being elected to an unemployed man? Is he supposed to feel less hungry because Lincoln was elected? Or Wilder was elected down there in Virginia? That didn't change my employment situation one whit. And it didn't change the employment situation but maybe of a handful of blacks who may get a few jobs, the tokens. But what does it really mean in the deepest sense of the word? So what do we get? We elect people so that we can get what we call vicarious pleasure out of their being elected. No, other people elect people so they can raid the treasury, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the deal is about. We elect people because they say, we're going to get you more housing, we're going to get you more welfare, we're going to get... No, get the money, bring the money. How about the house? The New York Board of Education spends about over $6 billion. That's just one unit of New York City. The New York Board of Education is still basically controlled by Jews and white folks, even though 80% of the students are blacks and Hispanics. Why are they continuing to hold on to this board and hold on to this system, even though their children are not in it? Because it's what? Money. That money makes millionaires for people. Do you understand? They feed their teachers, who are the majority of the system. They feed the construction industry. They feed the vendors of all types and kinds. In other words, they can pass on those billions of dollars to their merchants. And they don't have to have a half brain in their head to make it. You see, they tell you you have to be rich to be smart, don't you? Nothing like that. You have to have connections to be smart. You have to have connections to be what? Rich. That's all. One man sits, your group is sitting on the board, and your group then passes you to what? The money. And you create millionaires because you can do it, the money. That's why they stay on the board. Think about the wealth that I could have if I merely stole the New York Board of Education. Chalk. Pencils. I could be a retard and get wealth behind that. All you have to do is order the pencils or the chalk from what? The manufacturer as a middleman and what? Take it over to the Board of Education and have them have you a check back and you got money. You see? But we are not taught to think in terms of government and office and so forth as money and wealth creation and the redistribution of wealth. We are made to think of the election of people as symbols and models and do not demand a redistribution of the wealth once they get into office. Why do you think these people spend millions of dollars to get their man into office or in an office that may pay $25,000 or $30,000? Understand? You wouldn't have to have politicians running to get you more welfare if they're running in their election to office. They shift those millions and billions of dollars into your community to the people. No more welfare for you. You got the money coming directly. It's your money anyway. You pay taxes, don't you? But again, miseducation and not understanding the relationship between government and money, politics and money, has destroyed us as a people. We do not understand, of course, the economic historic repression we've had. I mentioned here, we don't have a sense of territoriality. We just let anybody come in, take out any amount of money they want to, do whatever they want to, and leave. We're the only group of people that will let this happen. Limited vision. Some people say, well, you know, you can't get into black capitalism, this and that. That's because we don't think. You must recognize that we elected people are all over this globe. And we are a large people. When you think of asking the economics, you must not only think of economics within the United States, you must think of African economics as a global system and developing a global African economic system. Now, when you think of an African economic system, you're not just talking about 30 million or 40 million African people in America. You're talking now, what, 300, 400, 500 million of people. You're talking about countries where your movements can be sold, countries where your services can be sold. You're talking about millions and millions of people who can be engaged in business. But it's because, again, we have been permitted our vision to be narrow that we have not seen the tremendous possibilities that we have. Oh, we don't have time. This is too bad. Too much to talk about. I wanted to mention, and I'll just do the outline here, and I just want to mention here, by the way, you know, we can talk about people buying sneakers and BMWs. I want to indicate, of course, that the black middle class is no better than the drug dealers on a certain level either. Both are consuming symbols, objects. Both are not investing in the real money anywhere. The black middle class is very poor in terms of wealth. Very little money in real productive investments. Little money in stocks, little money in bonds, relatively little in real estate, business. I mean, almost, it doesn't even count. The 256th business on the 500 list. The number 256 business on that business list, the white business, earns as much as, what was it? How many of it is, if I can recall now? 100 black businesses on the Black Enterprise magazine list. You understand what I'm saying? And you have nerve enough as black middle class saying you're only different from white folk in the color of your skin. You're very different from white folk. You're not even getting to approach white folk. In fact, you say you go to school to learn the same thing white folk learn. Frankly, you could learn the same thing white folk learn by going to school with white folk. Because one of the first things you would learn was that white folk own their own universities. There's no animal like this black middle class animal. And he acts like white folk. He thinks because he dressed like white folk, he's like white folk, he acts like white folk. Because he talks like white folk, so he has the same degree from same school, he's like white folk. You gotta be kidding yourself. If you act like white folk, you know who acts most like white folk if you wanna play that game? Farrakhan. That's why he's fighting such a death. Because he talks the same talk they talk. I don't want to sleep with you. I don't want to live with you. I want to have my own territory and control of my own wealth. I want to own my own businesses. I want to own my own houses. I want to deal with you in terms of power, not nagging, and it frightens to the death. But the Negro's supposed to act like white folks. Let me live with you. Love me. Look beyond my color. Accept me, you know. No. Let me send my children to you, even though you say you hate their guts. White folks don't act like that. You know? Don't flatter yourself. We are separated from our African history. That's one of the reasons why we're in the trouble we're in as people. You think history is merely a remembering of famous events. You think history is there merely to stroke your ego and to make you feel good about yourself. I have criticized very straightforwardly black folks approaching history as hero worship and see and searching out great people. That is a part of it, ladies and gentlemen, but history is much broader than the worshiping of heroes. History is real and concrete in its effect. History has 1,000 answers to 1,000 questions. You must not only ask history about what great heroes you had. You must ask history about how do I solve this problem? How do I deal with this issue in my life? What methods and techniques have we used to cope with this issue, this situation? When you study, for instance, the history of the African family, you'll recognize that there was no such thing as the African family. There were a variety of African families, and African families evolved. And therefore, when you look at the problems facing the black family, you don't have to look at white folks. You look in your own history and see under what circumstances did black folks, did Africans take this family style, take this approach or that approach, and how did this approach solve particular problems or issues you face? Why is it that we buy the idea that the father is the only one who can raise a boy into manhood? We bought that from Europeans. Now what a trap we're in when you buy the idea that the father, the biological father, is the only one who can raise a boy appropriately to manhood. Then you have a system that splits the biological father off from the family. Now you're faced with a problem, aren't you? But then if you look back into your own anthropological history, you will see one of the ways we raised boys to manhood was not through the efforts of the single biological father, right? But the rearing of the boy into manhood was the responsibility of all male adults. Therefore, our families do not necessarily have to be crippled by an absent father if we look appropriately at our own history as people. But we don't look at the answers there. You'd be surprised at the wisdom and the knowledge and the greatness that our people have. Don't confuse oldness as being out of date. Don't confuse the idea of primitive as being less than what is new. European ideology and philosophy is regressive. It is backward and destructive. There is much more wisdom in our people and the history of our people than is current today in European philosophy and ideology. But you have to ask the right questions. You have to go in with the questions in mind. Being separated from your history then is a terrible situation to be in. And it has little to do with just forgetting your history. To be separated from your history is to be robbed of skills, to be robbed of coping techniques. I'm going to have to come back to you and talk to you about this because I'll have to deal with this concept of social amnesia. Amnesia. Amnesia has been deliberately inculcated in the minds of black people. Your children and our children having problems remembering their lessons is deliberately set in. You must forget many things in order to be servants to these other people. You must not have a long memory. The Jews in New York now are having a fit about Bishop Tutu being in Dinkins' camp in Dinkins' inauguration. Why? Because Bishop Tutu had nerve enough to tell them that they should forgive the Germans. And now they said, don't bring him in. We don't want to be speaking to him. He doesn't know Jewish people. We don't forget like that. We're going to hold these Germans responsible for what they've done And we're going to continue to hunt them down and punish them and deal with them for what they've done to our people. In fact, these Bible reading Negroes misread history altogether and misread Bible so severely. If you really believed in that Old Testament, if you really read it correctly, you'd be tearing up this nation. If you let somebody gift you into this business, that Lord will take care of you. No way. No, sir. Reread that Old Testament again. All right? Reread Moses killing of 3,000 people and figure out why he had to kill 3,000 people at the bottom of that mountain. You remember that? No, because you know, in your little Sunday school, they just talk about the law, and they skipped over that part, right? The Bible is a whole lesson in statecraft, a whole lesson in intelligence gathering, war, and the whole, I mean, this is why these people who are less than 3% of the U.S. population literally run this country, because of that Old Testament, because the Old Testament teaches them all the kind of technology there is in the world, because you see it all there. Moses comes down, and why does he go up on the mountain? He goes up on the mountain because apparently these people are not even Jews in the truth, in the religious sense of the word yet. Otherwise, he wouldn't have any need to go up on the mountain to do what?
Get the law.
Yeah, to get the laws and the rules. Apparently, they are in great disorder, aren't they? They are fighting among themselves. They're having terrific problems. But they've got to survive among their enemies. Moses then has got to go up on that mountain and come down with a unified system of values and orientation and to lay on these people, because he knows they cannot survive among their enemies if they do not have this unity. And he goes up and brings the rules down. And then he sees them partying and living it up and carrying on, making gold calves and all the other stuff, worshiping the other people's gods. They're still worshiping Egyptian gods, by the way. The gold calves is an Egyptian god, right? And what does he tell them? All of you who believe and go with me, what? Step up here. And those of you who don't, what? Stand there. And then what does he do to those who stood there? Out. Slain on the spot. Why? Because we can't survive with division among ourselves. I'm in these places here. And you read and misread. You don't read the Bible, you read into the Bible. Because people have already set your mind up in such a way that you can't see what's right in front of your eyes. Yes. How many of you read about the killing of the 24,000 Israelites for hanging out with Midianite women? Read, ladies and gentlemen. When did God desert these people? When they forgot who they were, when they forgot their identity, when they forgot their personal relationship with their God, start worshiping the gods and values of other people, start speaking the language of other people and getting hung up in other people and whatever, every time they did it, whatever, into bondage, into prison. They have learned that lesson well. You who call yourself children of Israel have not learned that lesson well. And they don't forget it. You were willing for a cup of coffee and a hot dog sitting by a white person to forget all of the degradation that your ancestors went through at the hand of white
people. Tell it.
So you must have amnesia in order to live that way and feel comfortable with the murderers and killers of your people and people who still have it in their minds to enslave your children and use your children in the future. You gotta have a restricted mentality in order to be comfortable with that situation. That's why you're gonna see the restricted mentality in the classrooms and other places. This is an economically sanctuary, ladies and gentlemen.
You see in the African American the adoption of foreign methods. Methods not related to his African background, nor to his political economic realities. And the major problem today in the economic development of white people is the lack of an economic system based on what I call a sound cultural analysis. And I don't mean a cultural analysis that goes on talking about how white folks mistreated us. That is not a cultural analysis, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot of people here just going, doing endless research on how white people mistreated black people and getting all fired up over these kind of issues instead of looking deep into the heart and soul and mentality of black people and looking deep into the character of black people and looking deeply at the organization of money and economy within the black community and using that analysis to create a realistic system. We got a lot of fools here reading Marx and other kinds of people whose analysis is based upon Europeans and who then come in with preconceived ideas to impose upon the African situation. And one thing I pointed out again and again and again, you can look at any African society, and whether it is Marxist, socialist, capitalist, or any other kind of ist, it is poor compared to its European people. And that must recognize then that the problem we confront is deeper than subscribing to European doctrines of Adam Smith and Marx. That subscribing to these European doctrines are not the solutions to our problems. Marxist theory is based upon an analysis of European culture, and his economic recommendations are based upon that analysis. And we have some fools here who want to call it scientific, and this is somehow universal and above and untouchable. And yet when they look at it in country after country in Africa and other places that have subscribed to it without being realistic about their economic and social position in the world, they can see that it has not benefited very much those nations and those people. And yet they react by holding on even more tenaciously to a philosophy that even the Russians are throwing out, that even the Chinese are throwing aside. And everybody's throwing aside that this Negro, the poorest of all, who is still trying to hold on to it for dear life, and is not surviving. Does that mean Marx's ideas are no good? No. Doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean we can't use them? No, I'm not saying that either. What I am saying, though, is develop your economic and social philosophy based upon your own political and social reality first. Now, you may find, as I have found when I look directly at the heart and soul of our people, that many of your conclusions may coincidentally parallel those of Marx. But the origin is not Marx. The origin is from our own selves. And that means that those ideas are our possession. And we don't have to ask white Marxists or any other group to interpret them for us. Any other group doesn't come into us and say, well, you know, our people started and Marx was a Jew or whatever, and, you know, we have the right to interpret what he meant by this and that. We don't have to deal with that. We can deal with it because we've developed it out of our own hearts and our own souls and our own reality. When I was trying to go into business, it puzzled me for a long time. Where is the black money? Where is it? You know? Black people, we hear again and again, if you look at the collective earnings and resources of black people in America, you have to recognize that they are the ninth or tenth richest nation on this earth. That we trade more with this country than does the whole nation of Canada. That we represent a tremendous amount of wealth. And that the problem then with the black community is not a problem of poverty, but it is the correct utilization of the wealth that we have and the correct development of the wealth that we have as people. It is the malallocation of the money that we have, not the lack of money at all. I was interested in one example he gave here of the Japanese tailor who was selling suits for $35, and he's selling to other poor Japanese who cannot pay $35 at one time for a suit. So how do they solve the problem? The tailor's got to stay in business. The other people need a suit. Do they go down to SBA and apply for a loan? They could afford $5 a week, though. So they pull seven people together, then the seven put in their $5, and the first man gets his $35 suit. The tailor gets paid. The other man takes the suit home. And the next week, the next $35 come in, and on it goes. And the money revolves, and the wealth revolves, and there's growth and development within the community, you see. Not looking outside of themselves, but looking where? Within themselves, because ultimately that is the source of wealth. Not being externalized, but internalized, and looking into themselves as the basis of wealth. And using the revolving credit, these people did not go on welfare because they saw the welfare of their people as being their responsibility. And they organized in groups and clans and so forth and sought to the welfare of their members, so that it was not necessary for them to go on welfare. And they took care of their members. And it served some other social and political purposes as well. It's very interesting to note those purposes. Contrast that with the Urban League and the social work approach that we find so prevalent in our community. That does not harness the resources of the so-called poor and use those resources and recirculate those resources and organize the poor in a way that their money can increase and be used for their advantage, but, you know, takes a social work approach of delivering services from some external agency onto the people. A part of the receipt of benefits within the Japanese society was that you had to be a member of that society. And you were connected in that society. You were unified with the group. And it's within the context of this unity and membership that protection for the members take place. I realized as I tried to develop this business over here, that the problem was not money in getting this business, you know, because I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, you must be paying healthy rent over there. But my idea was if the Asians could pay their rent in Harlem and make a living using only whose money? Black folks' money. Black folks' money. They're not even using Asian money up there. The Koreans are not even coming up there to do their shopping and the others. They shopping somewhere in Koreatown, maybe somewhere else. Okay? Hispanics, you know, it's our money supporting their families, paying that rent. And believe me, rent on 125th Street can go as high as $5,000 or more a month. Favorite Shoes pays $10,000 a month right on that corner. But they have employees there, ladies and gentlemen. They're making money there. That implies what? That there is money over there. And if you can support this kind of rent with our kind of money, then we can support our own people with this kind of money. We can employ our own children with this kind of money. We can train and apprentice our own youth. We can get them out of the idea of having to steal and do the other kind of things that they do in these other places. We can build respect for self. I might have mentioned the fact I ran into one lady one evening. She mentioned that she lived out there somewhere. And I saw some sick Negro piece in New York Magazine. This a very ill piece, if you read this one here. Blacks at the top. Read this confusion. Very, 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 very ill. Pitiful. Because it shows they've reached the top and they still have problems. Identity problems and all kinds of other problems. That Frazier talked about even years ago in the black bourgeoisie. And somebody says, I'm scared to go to Harlem. You know, it's got a bit scared. It is a pity when you become more frightened among your own people than you do among another group of people. That is a real indictment, and many of us have that kind of fear. And we talk about the Howard Beaches, but still, on the whole, many of us still feel a little safer walking those communities of other communities than we do of our own. That is a major indictment of us as people. And who are we frightened of? Of our youth. Of our youth. That they're going to snatch our pocketbooks, they're going to stab us, they're going to do something to us. And that's a real fear, and it's a fear that has to be dealt with. And I'm not saying this is an illusion. It's real. And I'm not covering it over. It's a fear. It's a real concern. But what is the solution? To run out to Westchester? To run out here? Is that the end point of it? Not at all. In fact, that is a part of the basis for that fear having been created. I told her, so you know, you, and she said, oh, they don't have, give me any respect. I said, but it's interesting that you want respect from these youngsters when you're hardly contributing anything to their economic and social development at all. Why should they respect you? When you take your monies and your brain power and your other interests out and give it to another people, in a way, their anger and hostility has a certain logic to it. Because we have betrayed them. We have not given them an economic and social system and political system and network. We have not given them their inheritance and their due. We've robbed them of their inheritance. And consequently, they strike back at us with the only weapons that they're left, with. With dishonor and with disrespect. And when we speak, they don't listen. Why should they? You don't pay my bill. Right? You pay the right. What do we have to say about it? We are not feeding them. We are not caring for them. It's Big Daddy White Man. He's the ultimate papa in the world. So I can only, the only person I need to listen to is that one. And therefore, if we're to get back our self-respect and the respect of our children, then we have to establish control over our economic and social situation. The ownership of 125th Street, the ownership of all of these other streets around here, the ownership of downtown Manhattan is greater than any series of 10,000 lectures about the greatness of African people, I'm telling you. It's a contradiction to talk to your children about the greatness of African people. And then when they walk out, you know, the whole community and everything is owned by somebody else. It's a joke. And in the end, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to be bothered with it. Because it doesn't develop into anything concrete, usable, a type of pride that doesn't take them anywhere, and they see often only leads them to trouble, and a kind of radicalism that doesn't permit them to become, quote-unquote, a part of so-called mainstream. African nationalism must pay. We must demonstrate to people that believing in this ideology is not taking the side of poverty and degradation, but is a movement into wealth, and a movement into power, and a movement into greatness. And this is a part of the thing I'm about there. I'm trying to demonstrate, hey, I believe in Africa. I love Africa. I am African. And I believe in the greatness of my people. And it what? It pays. It pays. There's wealth connected with this belief. There's power connected with this belief. There's strength and respect connected with this belief. Not just an empty knowledge of history and an empty boasting that tries to substitute for a hungry stomach, but something that's real, that translates into real power. This is what we must demonstrate. And when our children grew up, I didn't see that. The Africanness is absorbed into their very bone marrow. It becomes a part of their lifeblood. And there's no reason why we cannot think of taking over the economic reins of this country. When we look at, and what the thing that I learned there, and the thing that I think you see in these many examples that light gives here, is not so much the money, but the social relationship between people as being the very key. The social relationship and interrelationship between people. These systems cannot work unless there is trust, unless there is confidence in one another. Some of these associations work because they were kinship groups. Some of them work because they came from the same village or carried the same last name. But they came from some cultural entity that tied them together emotionally and socially such that they could trust each other. They could make laws there without collateral because their words were their bond, and it was important that their family honor be kept high because that was the basis for which they gained their wealth to advance their economic and social interests, you see. So that when I say something, I say it because my family will back me up, and even if I fail, my family will see that my debt is paid. Because it is dishonorable for me to make this pledge to you from my village, from my people, from my background, and not pay you back. And the whole family was a part of that, you see. And you can see then, it was the social relationships, more so than the banks or any other financial instrument that we look so much to today, that was the foundation of the growth and development of these people and allowed them to move forward. And I recognized in my own business development over there in Harlem, it was the same thing, as I told you. I lost my job last year because of the kinds of stands I take. But I saw this place there. And how did I get it? Because I had talked to a guy in friendship one day. Comes up to the shop. We just talked. Oh, yeah, I remember you. You used to be on the radio. You used to be the communicator. You know, and some of you might remember the communicator back in the 60s, 70s, RVR. Beautiful vignettes of black life and the whole bit. And so you just talk and reminisce, and, you know, there's a whole beautiful social moment there of connection. And we became friends. And then I saw this place to be rented there. And I went downtown, and I said, let me see who owns this place so I can see what the rent is. Still, there's no money in my pocket, you know. And I was telling people, because the first question they often ask, well, what's the rent? And right away when they hear the rent, they're through. I think, don't ask the rent, and don't ask about where you're going to get the money from. Cue in on what you want to do. And start about doing it as if you have what is necessary to get it done. So you'd be surprised at how things begin to fall in place for you. And then it forces you to begin to be creative, you see, and your thought processes and things like this, and to look at alternatives and things that were not visible before. They become visible then, but if you give up at the first instant when you hear that rent, then all the other parts are never going to come up. It's nil from that point on. I looked in there and I said, oh, this place is rented by Harlem Commonwealth Council. Let me call them up and ask about it. And when I called up, who answered the phone but the person I had talked to? Hey, this is you. Yeah, oh, this is you. I'm in now. That business, and of course, here comes these forms. What was your earnings last year? You know, all of those kinds of things. But I had a friend there. You see what I'm saying? Because I didn't have your accountant send us. I don't have that, man. I'm not, you know. We don't have that kind of thing, you know. This is my idea. This is my dream. This is, you know, where I want to go with it. Couldn't you send this? No, I can't do that now. But hey, I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to struggle for you. And he fought and he struggled, you know, and there were people in there who wanted to do business as usual. And he got through. Now my next problem was, how in the hell am I going to get the ring up? I got that. Creative thinking, though. Let's get upon the lady. Somebody's got a house here.
No?
Paid for. Oh, you got to take chances. You got to take risks. I mean, it's no business. And a lot of us want to go into business without taking risks. When we talk about Egypt and its greatness, Egypt had to defend its agriculture. It had to defend its wealth. It had to struggle. Often sometimes it had to take from. People lost lives and they took risks and chances. And too many of us want to be the goodies without taking any risk whatsoever.
The idea that you see involves more than just opening the eyes and exposing the retina to the environment. It means then, in a sense, the mind sees through the eyes and directs the eyes, is what to see. We, in hypnosis, we deal with something that we call sometimes negative hallucinations. That is, getting people, let's look at the other type of hallucination first, say the positive hallucination. The positive hallucination, of course, is getting people to see what is actually not there. To see things that are actually not present in reality. And of course, some of you probably have seen those kinds of hypnotic tricks where you tell the hypnotic patient or the client that he has a rabbit in his lap, and of course there's nothing there, and he then proceeds to pet it and play with it, even though it's not there. This is what we call a positive hallucination. You can also produce a negative hallucination. You can tell the hypnotized subject that an object which is right before his face is not there. And he will see everything except that particular object that you've directed him not to see. You see this sometimes in certain forms of schizophrenia, for instance. Some types of schizophrenics can look and see everything on this podium here except to have this tape, even though it's right there before their eyes. Sometimes it's fascinating when you look at people who are so-called mentally disturbed, particularly the schizophrenic, because you can see the enormous powers of the human mind. And in this instance, then, you have a mind that for some reason or other is instructing that patient not to see a particular object right before his face, and yet he's seeing all of the other objects around it very, very clearly. So what we're trying to talk about here then is that if your mind and your brain is inefficiently programmed, then that inefficient program will misdirect your eyes, will misdirect your senses, will create for you then a reality that is, in a sense, unreal. It will mean then, since you are missing reality and missing parts of that reality, you cannot efficiently cope with it. To a good extent then, when we look at the history of the African man in relationship to the European, we see a man whose reality has been created for him, whose mind and brain has been created in such a way that even the most obvious things in reality are overlooked and not seen. And this is often done through what we call this so-called education. Remember, I alluded to the idea of trained eyes, experienced eyes, which means in an individual's mind has been created so that the eyes can find what that individual is looking for. What makes you think then that the European who trains your mind is going to train your mind to see reality in such a way that it will overthrow his dominance over you as a people? How do you expect to see reality from a people who writes your history in such a way that you don't even see yourself there? So when you look at history, you're not there. You look at American history, you're not there. You look at world history, you're not there. You look at anthropology, you're not there. And if you are there, you're there as a primitive, Stone Age kind of people, never having written anything or contributed anything. You look at economics, and you're not there except perhaps as a commodity in and of itself. You look at mathematics, and you're not there. You look at every discipline, and you do not see yourself. What kind of reality, then, can we be looking at as a people when our minds have been trained in such a way that we have literally negative hallucinations as well as positive hallucinations? It's amazing, then, that when we look at these disciplines where we don't see ourselves, so many of us call this kind of education in these disciplines a good education. It's an amazing kind of thing. You've had a people who have hung you, lynched you, degraded you, enslaved you, killed Indians, colonized people all over the world, killed millions and millions and millions of people, exploited people, destroyed people, polluted the earth, have done such a job on the earth until you begin to wonder if they come from the same planet. You begin to wonder if these people are not a type of infection, a virus whose purpose it is to destroy the health of the world itself. And as we see them now beginning to destroy the earth and now getting ready to move their destructive natures into the cosmos itself, they've already made it to the moon and are now preparing to infect the whole of the universe. How can you then, as a people, assume that the people who've done all of these kinds of things to us as a people can give us a vision of reality? How can we accept their description of reality as the one with which we are going to guide our own behavior? How can we believe a people whose very lives depends upon our continuing domination? And yet there are those among us who seem to want to believe this, who seem to want to push their children under the instructorship of these people, who seem to want their people to resemble these people in some fashion, who have the nerve to see these people as representing some kind of civilization. These people may represent a culture, but not a civilization, particularly if we're going to look at the word civil in the sense that it is normally used. We saw this thing here. In fact, last week I remarked, somebody had a conference here somewhere, and they voted against or they condemned terrorism. In fact, I saw someone proposed that the meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev would involve a discussion of terrorism. And I found that so amusing. In fact, I find the newspapers and the TV, particularly the news, very, very amusing. And they're real jokes to watch. And in a way, you're looking at these guys and they're going to talk about terrorism. And yet, here are the world's two greatest terrorists sitting in conference. Two people in the world who have the world wondering, when is the end going to come? When is one of them going to go off and drop a bomb that is going to destroy the life of man and perhaps life on earth, period? The very fact that they are seen as powerful people, the very fact that the world sat in intense attention when they met, is symbolic of the fact that they are holding the world in a state of terror. And that we are frightened that they may, for some reason or other, let loose the great power that they have under their hands. And yet they have nerve enough to talk about terrorism as if it belongs to another people. And yet these are the people many of us want to claim that we want our children to be just like. These are the people we want our children to share a piece of the pie with. And yet these are the peoples whose very weapons are weapons of death. These are the people who represent death in the world. One of the things I recognized when I went through the graduate schools, and that struck me again and again and again, and that was this idea that these people are dead. They're not alive. And dead people are deadly. What kind of civilization can it be when the more civilized you become, the more deadly you become? How can you justify that as civilization? We as a people then have to recognize that there must be an alternative to this kind of being. That the idea of our people is not to share equality with these people. Because the system that they represent is one that in and of itself should be rejected. What kind of education, and the brother wonders sometimes why I don't want to be called doctor, or I don't want to be called this and that. In a sense, I think if we think about it very closely, we should be very hesitant about giving ourselves those titles that are conferred upon us by these other people and what they so-called represent. Because we have to recognize that the educated individual is the craziest of all individuals. That the educated individual is the most dangerous of all individuals. When this world comes to its end, it will not be brought to an end by the muggers on the streets, ladies and gentlemen. It will not be brought to an end by the drug addicts, by the street prostitutes, by the youth gangs. It's going to be brought to an end by people with PhD degrees. It's going to be brought to an end by people who studied physics and mathematics, who spent 15 and 20 and 30 years in school. It's going to be brought to an end by people who live in nice clipped lawns with houses on the corner, with neat hedges, two-car garages, nice little well-spoken children, the people who send their kids to private school. And one morning they'll go off to work and give their wives a nice little bourgeois kiss. and then they'll go down and sit in front of the console of their computer and proceed to blow themselves up along with the rest of the world. What kind of education is it that leads to these kind of people, ladies and gentlemen? These people are being educated into madness. A real Afrocentric education would not educate people in such a way that they then develop tools of death and destruction, that they become the endpoint of a destructive procedure. When you must recognize then that these very people you bow and dip to and defer to, these very so-called experts, are the people who are going to take you directly to hell. Because you are responding to them not in terms of truth, not in terms of what they're really saying, but in terms of their symbols of authority. And because they lay these symbols of authority on you, they can tell you any kind of nonsense, and you're ready to believe it. And because they threaten you and intimidate you with their degrees and with their so-called learning, you're not willing to follow your own common sense and question what they have to say and where they're going and what they're doing. And you don't have sense enough then to say, wait a minute, if you are so well educated, if you are so liberal, if you are so perceptive, if you are so concerned, why are you making weapons of death that will destroy you, your children, and the futures of mankind? Why are you then living in the laps of luxury, having far more wealth and money than you could ever use, while millions and millions of my people are starving and dying the world over? So we must recognize then that these kind of people cannot lay a correct perception of reality upon us as a people. And we must recognize that the very educated among them are the very ones who are responsible to a great degree for creating the distorted reality we face today. We have to recognize that knowledge in and of itself does not represent the salvation of mankind. You saw this in the book of Genesis, didn't you? Where Adam and Eve were told to stay away from the tree of knowledge. And the old devil there was telling them, what? Eat of it. You should be as gods. If you get a hold of this fruit, you'll be able to know good and evil, and you'll see right and wrong. You can see just as good as God sees, and in a sense, you will become God yourself. And they ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And from this point on, we see that knowledge was not the salvation of man. And you can see it today in the Caucasian, who believes that the more knowledge he gets, the more somehow he's going to be able to be godlike. He thinks that if he gets to know more about DNA, he's going to be able to create life, and perhaps he will to a degree. But have you also noticed that the more knowledge he's gotten, the more of a danger he's become to the world? And that the more he's gotten to know about the atoms and the so-called foundations of the world, the more he has also gotten to know about how to create death and destruction. So consequently, he is in a race with himself, thinking that knowledge will save him, when all it does in most instances is push him closer and closer to the end of his life on earth. And so the Russians feel as if they knew a little more about the United States, a little more than the United States, then they would be able to defend themselves against the warlike nature of this country. And therefore they learn a little more and build a more dangerous weapon. And the United States then feels if it knows a little more than the Russians know, he will defend himself against their weapons, and they move a little closer to death and destruction. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it is a people who have been educated in terms of knowledge, but not in terms of the spirit, not in terms of the heart, and not in terms of the soul. It is a knowledge that is dead and materialistic.
Do not be deceived by this kind of thing, ladies and gentlemen. It is quite possible. Even if you don't think it's possible, you have to prepare for the what if. I've often mentioned to people about the Martin Luther King dream, you know, and he lays out the dream. It's a beautiful dream, I've remarked. But then that dream is also based on an if. You know, if they will love us, if they will accept us. And there are a lot of propositional statements in there. You know, if the economy is good and all of these kinds of things, then little black boys and white boys and girls may hold hands together. But we recognize that this is a propositional statement that's being made here. But you also have to ask the other question, what if it doesn't work this way? You see? What if the dream does not come true? Another problem we have often, we believe in the American mythology of progress. We as blacks have bought that idea. We bought this idea because America has advanced to some degree over time, and many of us just automatically assume that things have got to get better. That's sort of the American way of thinking, isn't it? You know, we got it today, it's got to be better tomorrow. There's no law that guarantees you in any way that things have got to get better, ladies and gentlemen. There's no universal rule that says life has to get better, that says race relationships have to get better, simply because you were in slavery some years ago and now you have a so-called relative degree of freedom. The idea then that you can never go back into slavery, or the idea that you can never re-experience reconstruction and the other kinds of things. To think that this is not going to occur, there is no law in the universe that tells you that that this cannot be the case. There's also this belief in the invulnerability of the white man, and the belief that somehow he's going to always protect his interests and be able to advance his interests, and therefore as long as we hang in with this guy and protect himself, coincidentally he'll protect us. There is no law and rule in the universe that says the white man is going to rule forever. As a matter of fact, if you look at history, it's going to be very clear that the civilizations built by the white man shall perish as the others have perished. So even in the good times, wise people prepare for bad possibilities. Even if we were to hold hands with little white boys and white girls, and you know, that was all this great Martin Luther King dream, that still does not say that we should not prepare for the other possibilities, because they can't occur. Recognize that all of these dreams are often based on, very much based on economic systems, and when economic changes come about, these dreams turn into nightmares. And recognize, let's look at an example here. Look at New York City and the problem we're having with education in New York City. This problem we're having, particularly in terms of African Americans, is very much connected with the economic situation in New York City. Ask yourself the question, what if we educated 100% of black and Hispanic children in New York City? They read well, they passed, they could pass all the civil service exams and the whole bit. But what would happen if the economy of New York City did not expand to accommodate all of these great graduates and plus the other people who are also graduating at the same time? You see, we assume simply because we keep getting more degrees that there will be automatically more jobs out there. But that is not necessarily the case. You can educate a vast number of black and Hispanic children. You still have not solved the problem that there may not be a market out there to absorb these kids when they get out there. And you will see then some more furious confrontations taking place of a prepared group of people and educated group of people who now cannot find jobs. And if you think the other people are unwise and unhip to this, you got another thought coming. So consequently, it becomes wiser for them to pretend that we're having tremendous problems in education, where you chop off over 50 or 60 or 70% of black and Hispanic children early in school, and you can say they don't work because they're not educated, and therefore everybody gets off the hook. But you can see the miseducation of these children is in part related also to the economic structure. It means that the economic structure has to expand at the same time you increase the number of graduates from secondary and from collegiate institutions. If the economy does not expand, the dreams of Martin Luther King will not come true because the economy cannot finance these dreams. And these dreams have to be financed by something. And so we have to recognize then what is going on in reality here. You have to ask yourself then, in so many years of education, to what degree are we as people and African people in a position to really protect our biological interests? And ladies and gentlemen, I believe that the biological interests of black people, the biological survival of black people, is in question. I'm not talking about quality of life. I'm talking about life itself. As I've often said, when we look at this situation, the military situation, the situation of pollution and so forth, what African nation, if the Caucasians decided tomorrow that they wanted to re-enslave African people, what African nation or group of people could militarily defend the interests of black people? With the kind of space weaponry we have floating around in the atmosphere, what African nation could defend militarily its own people, the people in the world? In what way has all of the college education and the degrees in engineering and so forth we have gotten advanced our ability to defend ourselves militarily and in other ways? Let me look though quickly at something else, and let's try to context education in terms of this. I often talk about what I call constants. A child reaches a major milestone in its development when it can recognize constancies in the world. That is, when it recognizes how the world stays basically and essentially the same in many important areas, even though it appears to be changing. And even though in terms of its sense organs, it is changing. If you were to look at the images of this room on my retina or cornea, the room certainly would not have its rectangular shape, because it would actually be shaped very oddly. This door passes, I move, each time I move, the door would change shapes. Even though perceptively, as far as I see it, it still stays the same. But actually, in terms of the image that's projected on my retina, it is constantly changing with every movement I make. And not only is it changing relative to me, but its shape is changing. And if I were to go on just what is thrust on my retina, I would have to lean sideways or all kinds of ways trying to get through this door. But what happens is my brain corrects the image that is projected on my retina. And it maintains a constant image of this door, despite the myriad of changes that may be projected on the retina of my eye. So it permits me then, despite where I stand in this room, how I move, to move very efficiently through that door. Because my brain is maintaining a constancy of perception, despite some obvious changes as projected on the retina. It is very important that we keep this in mind, because if you don't maintain a perception of the constants, then you will be deceived by every change in the world. You know, someone says, the French have a statement that goes, the more things change, the more they remain the same. You know, and often many things change so that they can remain the same. And often we have been deceived by the changes that have happened, let us say, in this country. We look at slavery time, we look at Reconstruction, and we break history up into these various parts. And often we compare what opportunities we have available to us today against when we were in slavery and against when we were segregated and against it. And it looks like we've come through tremendous changes. And we get the idea that the world has changed drastically. And of course, this feeds into the mythology of progress. That if it's changed this much since that time, it's got to get better further on down the road. But then you must recognize that there are certain constants that are still behind these apparent changes. And I'll mention some of the constants here. There could be others, of course, you can come through. When you talk about the European, you must recognize the European is only about 10% of the world's population. And that's a very important concept to keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen. It sounds like a coincidental statement, but it's one that's important because a great deal of European psychology and orientation to the world is based on their minority status. We as Africans and people of African descent are a part of the world's larger majorities, not minorities. The European is a small group of people. It is a minority group of people. And that minority, its minority status has shaped its psychology and its orientation to the world, both consciously and unconsciously. And often then, for this minority to maintain its control over the world, it must, of necessity, maintain an enormous military power. And this is one of the constants that it's going to seek to maintain no matter how many white boys and girls you hold hands with. No matter how many white people you sleep with and marry and all of this kind of stuff, this is a constant. Military power. An overwhelming military power. As a matter of fact, it was a part of that military power that has you here today. And you can see today the greatest problem in this country and in Russia and in other European countries involves money spent for military outlays. A vast consumption of the country's wealth and resources goes into military resources. And despite the fact that you tell these people you have enough weapons now to kill each individual 700 times over, they still rob everybody to build up this military power. Because they recognize, being such a small group, that the only real advantage they have over these other large majorities is an overwhelming military presence. And now you can go to all of these schools and everywhere you want to go, but that's a constant. And that constant has been there since you first met the white man, and as a matter of fact, it has not been diminished since. And the intention is that it will always be that way. Even when you join the military, you'll still be a part of that whole set situation. It'll be set here. That's one of the constants that maintains that. The other constant, of course, is economic power. Maintaining economic control of the world. That control was being established when we first met this man in Africa. It has grown since that time, and it is still maintaining itself at this time. You can get as many jobs as you want to on Wall Street. You can work for IBM. You can work for all the rest. But the constant is that they're going to still be owned by Europeans. That they're going to still be controlled by Europeans. And that ownership and control is going to be used to manipulate the psychology of non-European people, to maintain the subordination and servitude of European people. You think now because you have a choice, you can choose computer engineering, and you can choose this and that somehow you have it over your great-grandfathers who were slaves? Let's look at that concept. Of course, not every black slave was a field hand. We had roles there too. Not every black slave was a house servant. You had carpenters, you had skilled craftsmen, you had people who were up to date, and I'm speaking of slaves now, in terms of crafts and skills, who worked in mills and factories and all of the other kinds of things. And yet, the ultimate thing was they worked for the benefit of their masters. They turned their profits over to their masters. That relationship has not changed one whit. The idea that because you got a degree in computer engineering or whatever you may call it, that you somehow have changed from your great-grandparent who might have been an iron worker and a steel one, that this has changed is only an illusion. Because as your great-grandparents worked to enrich his master, So when you get out of this school, you're going to work to enrich your own masters. Oh, they're not going to hold a whip over you. They're not going to, be as brutal perhaps, but the same essential relationship is going to be there. And therefore, it is the intention. As a matter of fact, the integration of our people into these jobs is still being done to maintain a grip on the economic system. So what do you do? As I often tell my students, you are being educated to put a black face on white power. I was reading something the other day. We were talking about conditioning. And in my psych class the other day, and how you use conditioning to manipulate desires and so forth in people, and to try to induce people to buy various items. And of course, it talked about the Coke campaign, how Coke would start off its campaign with Bill Cosby's show, how it would be identified with intimate groups and so forth, associations, how Michael Jackson, I believe, would be used as such, how Michael Jordan, the basketball player, would be used and shown drinking Coke and so forth, and how a black advertising agency would be hired to project this image to black people. It had Fernando Valenzuela for the Hispanics. It had reggae music for the Caribbean, about very cherry Coke. Someone told me that cherry in the Caribbean also has to do with being high, doesn't it? Someone ever heard that? So Coke is very cherry. And yet you see here then an association of a product with people's culture and with their backgrounds and with their values as a way of manipulating the mind, manipulating their desires and creating desires in them and increasing their consumption and using then black agencies and Hispanic agencies and Asian agencies and hiring black vice presidents. And it always amuses me when you read about the vice presidents of large corporations and you always get to this black person who's the vice president of special markets. Of course, he is the black man on staff whose special job it is to show these people how black needs and moods can be manipulated to earn greater money for the white company. So in the end, while you may point out that now you have black vice presidents, you have black advertising agencies, and how far we've come, when you get down to the very bottom dollar, it is still the old game of extracting resources and money and everything else out of black people and using them to enrich the economic power and resources of Europeans. And of course, the European has found out that it works better when you put a black face in the position to do this. So ultimately, he maintains his economic control by projecting and educating black people to do it. It's the same old game as neocolonialism. I don't think there's no coincidence that you have neocolonialism occurring pretty much in parallel to so-called integrationism or assimilationism in America. The same kind of game is going on, putting black faces on white power, because when you look under that black face, you'll still see economic control and economic manipulation being taking place. I was looking the other day, sometime back, I was reading in the New York Times about how many scholarships were available to black South Africans. In fact, there was more money available to black South Africans than there were black South Africans to take the money. And you say, well, now why is this? I mean, they're looking for them. Well, why wasn't this money available 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 30 years ago? Why is it being available now? Of course, the obvious situation is here that where the Europeans see that they will lose political power in South Africa, what they want to do, of course, is educate its next leadership generation. And of course, knowing how we eat up white degrees, we're going to, when these people go and get these degrees out of these Eurocentric institutions, we're going to respect them so highly, we're going to put them right into office, and they're going to bring their educated values and orientations right with them and help to maintain and repress the group in the interest of their European tutors and mentors. So now the money is being available. You read colonial history, you'll see often as the Europeans turned loose the so-called colonies, they established schools and institutions so that they can educate the leadership class. And of course, we can see what kind of problems that is involved. And a similar game goes on within this particular culture. By the way, you say, well, you know, we have to play that kind of game. Well, if I have to play that kind of game and eat, I'm going to do it. But there's no assurance that you're even going to eat. If you had read last month, in fact, still this month, Black Enterprise magazine, you would have seen the lead piece in that magazine dealing with, what is it? How to survive, it's something like, how do you survive the cutbacks in the industry? And there's a whole article on there advising, like, how you get severance pay from these companies as they cut back. As a matter of fact, Graves says in that piece that a 500,000 middle management jobs have been knocked out since the early 80s, ladies and gentlemen. That there is a severe cutback. He's now, and he's speaking very clearly in terms of his own class interest. He says the black corporate class, whatever kind of class that is, he is strictly endangered. Then he goes on to say, that also means danger for the black people as a race. But of course he deals with this class first. And so what he's concerned with is, he goes on to say further in that article, that there's concern whether there will be any black who's going to head a Fortune 500 company by the year 2000. And he mentions the idea that there are actually fewer black college graduates today than some years back. And the problem, he says, is how are we going to protect these the interests of these black college graduates when the ones that are currently in the industry are now on their way out, and so there'll be no one there to help pull them in at all. And so the idea that the degree is going to assure you some kind of job is very, very questionable, period, because there's a shrinking in terms of American economic might and the growth of the American economy. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, as I often said, civil rights laws, affirmative action laws, are no guarantee at all for you getting any kind of job. Too many of us have been raised to think that laws will protect our interests. Laws are not going to protect your interest one whit. Laws can only protect, and laws don't protect anything, as a matter of fact. It's people who protect interests. And the day that the establishment decides that it is not going to enforce the law, then the law is of no account. We saw that in Reconstruction. When Washington decided that it would no longer support the Reconstruction laws and so forth, then the whole thing collapsed. It took 100 years to get over that, to get back halfway where we were during Reconstruction. We look at the Reagan administration today. It just decides that it is not going to enforce the rules. The rules are on the books. But when it decides to send out a signal that it's not going to enforce the rules, then nothing happens. And believe this, ladies and gentlemen, if it ever gets to a point where there's a choice between the European feeding his child and feeding yours, no law in the world is going to make this man feed your child first. None whatsoever. So the ultimate thing is you cannot have faith in laws and things of this nature. You ultimately have to have power, real power. And to a good extent, you see, education ultimately has to be about that. Preparing a people and setting a people up to have real power so that they can protect their biological and other interests in times of stress. You see? And if, as I said earlier, if he doesn't do that, then it is not a sound education. I don't care how well you speak, what college you went to, who taught you as professors. If it doesn't add up ultimately to the protection of your interests, then it is not ultimately a sound education.